Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? And welcome to the show. This week, I am thrilled to tell you that we speak with three-time Canadian Olympian Rosie Etta, who also works as an entertainment correspondent on Entertainment Tonight Canada. She'll be here to talk about her career in track and field, as well as what it's like to work on a major entertainment show. We also speak with author and lifestyle expert Christine Eisner on the art of smart shopping at garage sales. Gina Lee of The Love Zone is here, and we have a killer remix for you from Kesha.
Capture your need for sound.
It's a great honor to introduce you to my next guest. Not only is she a three-time Olympian for Canada in the 88, 92, and 96 Summer Games, but she also holds the Canadian record for the 400-meter hurdles, has won a bronze medal at the 1990 Commonwealth Games, and she's also an important member of Entertainment Tonight Canada as an entertainment correspondent. Rosie Etta, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Very good. And Rosie, you know what? You've been leading this amazing life, and I can't wait to sort of ask you about, you know, some of the career paths you've been on. But if we start from the beginning, I understand that you were actually born in England. So how did you end up making the move to Canada?
I was really young. I still had my British accent when I got to Canada, and I used to tell everybody, I'm British, I'm British. But my dad got a job over here working for a chemical company, and it was a good offer, so we made the move over to Canada.
Now, as a child, did you always have aspirations to become an athlete and sort of compete in the Olympics, or did it just sort of happen, you know, organically?
I remember, this is dating myself here, but I remember as a kid watching the 76 Olympic Games. It was in Montreal. I was living in Montreal at the time, but I was watching it on TV. And I remember my mom took us by the Olympic Stadium just after it was built. And I thought, oh man, this would be so cool to run, to compete in the Olympics. I was drawn to track and field because I love that oval shape of the track. I thought the track was way too big for a little kid like me to run around, but I thought, well, maybe when I get bigger, I might be able to handle the size of the track and compete in some event. I had no idea what event I wanted to do. I didn't know if I wanted to be a sprinter, a jumper, but I knew that it seemed really exciting and challenging, and I thought, well, maybe if I dream really hard, I might be able to make this Olympic team. And again, I'm a kid. I had no clue how one gets to the Olympics. It's not like I was on a club and I was training as a five-year-old with the idea from my coach that I was going to make the Olympics. I was just a kid at home thinking, yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
And how did you actually, or what did it feel like making it onto the Olympic team for Canada?
The first time I made it was in 1988. I was a sprinter. So at that point, you know, years after starting as a junior athlete, I realized I was running the 100, the 200. I did some hurdles. I realized, you know, my talent, you know, lied within the sprint. So I was running the 100. Well, I was running the 200 and the 400. Back in the day, and they still practice this now in Canada, they pre-select a lot of the athletes based on their performances the year before. So in the 400, which was my best bet to make the Olympics in 1988, the 400, the field was completed. They had already selected the team. So you could run a world record practically, and you wouldn't be selected for the team because the year before, all these athletes had made the standard, and that was it. Door was shut. So I went, oh, okay, how can I get on this team? I really think I'm ready. So my coach said, Victor Lopez said, well, why don't we just combine the 400 and the hurdles? You're a pretty good hurdler. Let's run the 400 hurdles. So 1998, in January, I started running the 400-meter hurdles, and it wasn't pretty. It was a stop-start thing because the 400-meter hurdles is all about rhythm. You find a good rhythm, and then you just flow over the hurdles, and you don't find that just overnight. It takes time. I suffered shin splints and, minor nagging aches and pains, but I knew that this is the event. There was nobody pre-selected for the event. I thought, this time that they had, I believe it was about 56 seconds, 0.10. you know, 0.1 tenth of a second.
Yeah.
I said, that's within my grasp, because I ran the race for the first time ever in my life that year and ran, let's say, about 58.
Okay.
I went, well, I can do this. So I just kept running, and then I made it to the Canadian Championships, and I won.
Wow.
I know. I won. Believe me, I was ready. I was determined, but I was still very nervous. I didn't go into the race saying, I'm going to the Olympics. I'm going to make this. But I said, wow, this is the best chance I have in this event. And I just felt that I felt that it was possible, really possible. Like, I gave myself that little window of hope, and I just ran right through it. And so I won. I won the Canadian Championships. I ran the standard, and I went to Seoul, South Korea.
Wow.
So it was that, and so it just began from there, and then I never looked back. I kept always wanting to improve my time, to get higher up in the world rankings, and that desire was met by training hard and in the States with a great coach like Victor Lopez. There's a lot of competition. I'm in a sunny, warm climate, so 365 days a year I get to train outside. So it was just all about track and academics. That's all I had to worry about. Oh, gosh, I remember that. That was so lovely. I had no money. I had no home, no mortgage to worry about, but it was awesome.
That's so awesome.
I had a backpack. I used to go to Europe every summer and just race. And
wow.
race and run all around Europe, and just to improve my time, to compete, to get higher up in the rankings. And that's all I had. I had a bag, I had my spikes, and I had myself, and I had some books. And that was just, wow, that was just about taking care of yourself, you know, trying to achieve your dreams. And let me tell you, that was bliss. That was really great.
And when you look back now and realize that, you know, you've done all those races, and then on top of it, you know, to have competed in 3 Olympic Games
yeah.
for Canada, what does it feel like?
You know, I would say the past 7-8 years, I've actually started to look back. Because before that, let's say once you're done, you walk away from the track, like I did in the late 90s, early 2000s. I just kind of walked away and then moved on to television. So I never looked back. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But only in the past few years, I started to go, hey, you're pretty good. That was pretty neat. Because I was surrounded by incredible athletes who had competed in, you know, 3, 4, 5 Olympic Games. Charmaine Crooks, you know, she competed in 5 Olympic Games. So I did not think that Leah Pels, a great 1500-meter runner for Canada, she competed in at least 4 Olympic Games. I did not think that I was any more amazing than any of the other wonderful athletes that I was surrounded by. So you have to understand, I thought that most people go out there and train like crazy every day. I mean, it was a norm for me. So I didn't think that it was such an incredible achievement. But only after the last, I would say, a few years, I look back and go, wow, really? Nobody's broken that record? Oh, I guess it was pretty fast then. I guess it was pretty good. And I actually helped commentate for the World Junior Track and Field Championships last year in Moncton. So I was back in the milieu, and I realized what a wonderful sport track and field is. And I was so deeply proud of my accomplishments, of this country, and being able to represent this country in 3 Olympic Games. I really, really, really am proud of myself for my accomplishments.
That's fantastic. Joining us on the show is ET Canada's Rosie Etta. Make sure to check out her website at rosieetta.com. Now, Rosie, you just sort of mentioned a few moments ago that it didn't seem like it was a too big of a difficult transition for you to go from the track to something else, but I'm assuming there was a transition time. Did you know that's where you were headed? Is maybe that why it wasn't such a difficult transition?
It was so exciting for me. I did not plan this transition. I did not say, okay, in 2000, I'll be on TV, and I'll be working at CFTF 12 in Montreal, and then I'll be working at Global Television in Montreal, and then I'll go on to CNN. No. What happened was it was a fairly smooth transition, and that's why I didn't have the time to sit back and go, oh, right, I don't run track anymore. Oh, I miss those days. Because, boom, before I knew it, I got a call from this wonderful man. His name is Ron Roosh. He was the director of sports at CFTF 12 in Montreal. And he said to me, well, when you're finished running track, you need to come work for me. on television. I mean, wow, this is Ron Roosh. He's an icon here in TV in Montreal. He knows his sports. He knows his thing. And he said, you know what? I've been interviewing you for all these years. My guys have been interviewing you. I think you'd be great on television. So with that, I had a mentor. I had somebody, you know, in my corner, and I said, thank you very much. I will take you up on that offer. So I went in there, eyes wide open, kind of bug-eyed, and followed Randy Tiemann and Brian Wilde around. They're great, great, great sports reporters. And they were so kind to me and so giving. I learned so much from them, but I had very little time to learn. And before you knew it, I was on TV. So once again, back to that kind of pressure cooker where you had to perform and there's really no time to look back and go, oh, I don't know if I can do this. Hey, it's time. Get on the air. And I loved that. And that, so I thrived in that kind of situation. I had to learn a lot really fast. And, you know, I'm still learning today. But because of Ron Roosh, I was able to transition really quickly and didn't even have the time to sort of worry about where am I going? What am I doing? So I just took job after job, got a lot of freelance work in Montreal. It's difficult to get full-time work,
yep.
but I got the freelance work. There were some maternity leaves that I would fill up, and then they'd come back and I'd move to something else. But I went from sports, a little bit of weather, got some entertainment gigs. Once I got that bug, I said, you know what, I'd like to do some more entertainment. I think it'd be fun, and, you know, I'm always up for a challenge, so I didn't want to stick with sports because I came from sports, although I do love it, though. Mm-hmm. And then Leslie Roberts, who now is in Toronto, he was in Montreal, he gave me a book to read, and Ken Lindner and Associates, it's an agency in the States. I sent them a tape. They liked what they saw. They got me some jobs in the States, but you know what? I felt that Canada, I needed to come back to Canada. It wasn't what I was getting in the States, wasn't what I needed. And I heard about this job in Toronto. They weren't really calling it Entertainment Tonight Canada at that point, but I heard, you know, there was a buzz going on, mm-hmm. and sent my tape, and it was just as quick as that. I was working in New Jersey for MSNBC, and you know what? When you're not happy, you're not happy. And I needed to find something else. You know, I needed to be more creative, more myself. I needed to interview people. That's something I love to do. I did it a lot in sports, but I wasn't given that opportunity at MSNBC, and I needed to find that opportunity, and there you go.
And what's it been like being a part of ET Canada? Because it just seems like, you know, it's our Canadian version of, obviously, the juggernaut from the States.
Yes, yes, exactly. So first off, 2005, you know, we finally get to announce that we've got ET Canada coming out, and there I was, a part of it. It's been a wonderful evolution, because 6 years, and I sit back and I go, what, 6 years already? Are you kidding me? There you have that institution, you know, Entertainment Tonight, and now you have Entertainment Tonight Canada. We built up such a bank of footage and interviews. I feel like I've grown exponentially because of the types of interviews that I get to do. And it's not just because, oh, yay, I get to talk to Rob Pattinson and Brad Pitt and George Clooney, although I've not interviewed George Clooney yet. I will get him one day. But it's not just that. It's I get to use the skill, right? You got to listen. You know, to be a good interviewer, you have to listen. You know, yeah, you might have these predetermined questions, but the conversation might go a whole different way, and you got to be ready to go with that. And that's what I love. You know, whether it's interviewing an up-and-coming musician, a chef, or an A-list star, I look for those little, you know, sometimes it's just a minuscule moment where you make a bit of a connection and you laugh and it's a genuine laugh. That's fun.
And have you learned something, you know, Rosie, when you are interviewing, like you said, like the big guns, and then there's, you know, I suppose the little guys that are trying to get up there. Is there a difference intrinsically, or is you just treat everyone the same, like they're people?
In my head, they are people. They are just, they're like everyone else. But sometimes, of course, the situation may dictate that it is a little different. The energy may be different when you've got a big star like, let me just kind of think. I interviewed Robert Pattinson when the first Twilight movie came out. There was nobody in the room. It was just him. And I said, by the way, dude, this is going to be huge. They all looked and went, yeah, I don't know. We don't know. And then a few years later, I think it was two or three films later, I saw, I don't think I interviewed him after that, but I saw he had a publicist in the room. There's all sorts of rules and what you can say and what you can't say. So unfortunately, the dynamics can change when a star becomes really big because of the people that they surround themselves with. And they might really come at you and say before the interview, you cannot ask him about his personal life.
Okay.
And, you know, not that I really care about who that person's sleeping with, but your personal life is, you know, usually intrinsically linked to what you do professionally. And, you know, if you like to jump off buildings, maybe it's because you're a daredevil and you love taking risks. So I want to just ask about that. And if they're going to preclude me from asking those kind of questions, it does make it more challenging. So I try and be smart about it and respectful. But that's where it gets a bit dicey. Whereas if you have an up-and-coming star and, you're in the room, or you've got an artist who's, you know, a musician who's basically just got off the subway to come talk to you, you're not going to get that kind of energy, right? They're mm-hmm. they're open. They want to talk. They want to, you know, promote their album or promote who they are. So both are challenging in some ways, because you're trying to find out who this new artist is, because, you know, you may not know that much about them. The well-known artist may have a string of people around them who are trying to really craft and dictate the conversation. And you got to be strong. You really do.
And something I wanted to ask you, because I think you and I both end up doing the same job. You know, I'm on the radio, you're on television.
Yeah.
What do you feel like when, you know, because sometimes I've been denied an interview, and I feel like if the celebrity actually knew that I was mm-hmm. requesting them, they probably would have done the interview. But I find sometimes their publicists get in the way. Do you find that?
I think... Let's see. Let me try and think of an example like that, because nothing's coming to mind where I sort of, am lobbying to get to have an interview and I don't get it. Because for the most part, you know, the interviews that I do are set up already. They're
okay.
junkets, right? So
yeah.
they've got a movie that they want, you know, that they need to promote. And then they set up a junket and we get to interview them because we're on that list. You know, we're one of the television shows that is quite far reaching. We've got a pretty big audience, so we usually get invited. So I usually get to interview most of the people that I'm being told that I'm going to interview. There are times when, you know, time is tight and they're running late.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're told that your interview went from 5 minutes to 2 minutes.
Okay.
I can think of an example just recently in New York, Limitless with Robert De Niro and Bradley Cooper. I wasn't even sure if I was going to get them together. I wasn't sure if I was even going to be able to interview Robert De Niro. And then at the last minute, they go, you're in. You're going to interview Robert De Niro and Bradley Cooper at the same time. And you've got a couple of minutes.
Wow.
So as you know, that's not much time at all. And it's heartbreaking because I don't know if you know this, but Robert De Niro, oh gosh, you know, such a legend in his own time. And such a wonderful actor. You want to be in that kind of presence of greatness, but he doesn't give a lot, and you want to try and get something from him. So the first time I just got a little mumbling from him. I interviewed him for another movie. This time I actually got him to speak and to laugh a bit, and he said, well, that's a really good question.
Right.
I asked him, well, this movie Limitless, you take a pill and then your mental capacity is limitless. You become really creative and very, very smart. And would you do something like that? And so I just asked him, do you ever approach a role and wonder whether or not you have the creative capacity to really embrace this particular role? He liked the question. He pondered for a little bit and he never answered.
Oh, jeez.
So yes, I did get the interview with Robert De Niro, but it was cut so short that I couldn't really press him. He's not the kind of person that you really want to push too much anyway.
Yeah.
But I didn't get enough time with him, and I'd love that. I'd love a little bit more time with Mr. De Niro.
And don't you find, Rosie, too, that we end up as interviewers becoming like amateur psychologists, like to see what sort of mood they're in and trying to gauge it and sort of seeing, like you said, how much you can push, how much you can't, which direction you're going?
Yes, exactly. I had to do this questionnaire. I was not working for Entertainment Tonight Canada at the time, but I had to interview Rupert Everett. He's the British actor. And I was asked to ask a line of questions. I had to follow the questions, and it was a silly little game sort of thing. And
okay.
you know, they wanted to make it fun, and he just stopped me cold, looked at me, and went, "No, I, sorry, I, don't do this. And so I quickly had to shift gears.
Yep.
Going, okay, yeah, that's silly anyways. Let's go talk about you. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Without missing a beat, I couldn't let that awkward moment linger too long.
Yeah.
And I had to shift. And like you said, I had to feel the mood and go, no, this guy's not going to play. Just leave it alone and go to something else. And you really do. You have to go in there and be able to gauge the mood quickly, but you can't get intimidated, right? If you think, oh no, he's not smiling at me. And then right away, you don't even try to ask a few questions, then you're never going to get anywhere. I remember when Angelina Jolie, her mom died, and Billy Bob Thornton came into town, let's say a day or two maximum after her death. I know that he knew Angelina Jolie's mother, obviously. He was married to Angelina Jolie. So I'm asking him about his movie. Can't remember the name of the movie. Something about him and going to space. And the cowboy astronaut or something. It was actually a charming movie. And he was very charming. He was really sweet. He was, you know, he's got that wonderful Southern attitude where it's just, he's got the Southern manners and he's very sweet and polite. And I just had to ask him, and I asked him in a respectful way, I believe, you know, that I can't remember, I think it's Vivienne Jolie. Well,
she
just passed away, and I know that you knew her. What kind of a person was she, and what did she mean to you? I asked in that kind of way, and he stopped talking about the movie and went into a very, very long and detailed account of this wonderful lady and her life and how she will be missed. And so I felt that it was necessary, and it was a complete departure from the movie. And a lot of times they don't want you to throw that stuff at people, but I wasn't trying to sabotage or ambush him. I was just trying to simply, you know, express that we felt her passing. We know that she passed, and what did you think? And he was wonderful about it. And then that particular response was picked up on the wires and was reported around the world. And I was proud of myself for asking and for not backing down and for judging that mood fairly correctly.
Okay. Now, Rosie, I know that you have such a crazy busy schedule with your work on Entertainment Tonight Canada, and then you're also, you know, a mother yourself. What would you tell our women listeners who are trying to sort of do it all? Because I feel like you would, you know, I think you're obviously very good at organizing your time, and I feel so many of us are just all over the place.
Okay, so moms, I love you. I love all you moms, whether you're married and you're happily married, whether you're struggling as a single mom, or even you're struggling and you're married, you know, because it's not all easy. Just because you have a husband, I know it's still tough out there to be organized and to do it all. Guess what? I am really not, I'm kind of a messy person. And I let that happen, even though it drives my daughter crazy because she's the opposite. She is so neat. She's incredibly neat. But that's the one thing I have to sort of let happen. I'm not the neatest person, but I'm neat in my head, and I know what I have to do, and a lot of things are written down, or they're in my BlackBerry, or they're in my head. So I never miss a meeting. I get to work on time. I get things done for my daughter, but I allow myself that thing, which is being a bit untidy. Doesn't that sound better?
That's
untidy.
Awesome.
and I want to just say that mothers, oh, I know you feel like, oh, I'm such a bad mom because I was 2 minutes late to pick up my child, or, you know, I didn't cook dinner. We have to get takeout. Man, you got to give yourself a break. And if you have to give yourself a break every day, then you do just that. Because I'm really, really into that now. I leased a car, and when my lease was up, I said, you know what? I'm done. So now I actually gave up the car because I felt like I was a slave to it, and I felt so obligated to drive my daughter everywhere. She's older now, so I understand having a car when you have a toddler. It makes complete sense. Even when you have teenagers or a house full of kids, it makes sense. But I gave myself a break, and I said, you know what? I'm tired of driving my daughter everywhere, so I'm going to give myself a break, and I'm going to let her take the subway and the bus. And so you got to find those pockets where you can allow yourself to step back and go, you know what? I'm going to give myself a break. And the kids, if they're old enough, they're going to cook dinner on Wednesday. And that one little break can make such a difference. And I'm telling you, it looks like, you know, you might see all these people on TV and you hear their moms and they, you know, they have three kids and how do they do it all? There is no silver bullet. There's no magic pill. you got to give yourself a break. And I really, really want to say it's so important to take care of yourself, and you have to exercise. Even if you're at home by yourself and you sit down and during a commercial break, you do some sit-ups and you do even one or two push-ups during that commercial break, you've done yourself a favor. But you got to take care of your body. You got to be strong. Because if you're not strong, how are you going to take care of all those kids and your family? You got to be strong for yourself. And that's another way that I give myself, I call it a break. I actually go work out, and that's a break for me because it's all about me. Nice. I can't worry about anybody else when I'm working out. And you got to be all about yourself. You know, every single day there's got to be a point in the day when it's all about you, whether it's having a cup of tea, you know, and watching Oprah, then it's all about you. Do that, you know, even if you're only going to watch Oprah for 5 minutes and have that tea. I am so, as you can tell, I'm so passionate about that because us mothers, we work really hard. And even, you know, us mothers who stay at home and watch the kids all day work so hard. You know, okay, so you don't go out to an office, you know, you don't go to a cubicle. You stay at home and you take care of those kids. That takes up so much energy. And I want you moms to know that, man, I am so there with you. Yeah, I go out there and run around like a crazy person at work. And then I come home and take care of my daughter. But I so salute moms who have, you know, a wonderful husband and they got, let's say, the 2-3 kids or even the one child and they feel overwhelmed. I so hear you, and you're allowed to feel overwhelmed and you deserve it. And then just recognize it and then move on from there and give yourself that me time. And I know it sounds like a lot. I don't have any time. 2 minutes to sit down and tell everybody, leave me alone.
That's awesome.
And yeah, and just do that.
What's up next for you professionally, Rosie? Like, obviously, continue on ET Canada. Do you have other irons in the fire as well?
Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm working on a couple of different projects, but something that's really important to me is I'm now seeing I'm now seeing the merit and the worth in giving back because, you know, as a mom, it's all about taking care of your family. It's all about you and your little world. And, I got to pick up my daughter and I got to take her here and then I've got to go to work and it's all me, 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 me. Well, I'm starting to realize the value in giving back. And so I'm looking at, I was just approached by a charity and I'm deciding whether or not I'm going to partner with them. And I'm pretty sure that I will. And I'll make that announcement within another week or so. And it's a wonderful charity that focuses on the needs of mainly girls around the world, and they're also now they've got a new campaign that's starting up with focus on helping out boys as well, and it's just about building strength and self-esteem and encouraging education within these girls, which I'm very, very obviously very into. So I really am looking at giving back and becoming a big part of a charity, and I'm also really trying very hard. Believe me, Kelly, I'm trying with all my might. I'm writing a book and it's tough to get anything published. It's tough to find backers because this book will cost a little bit more money because there's more pictures involved, actual photographs. But, I want to say that I'm really not going to give up on this.
Good
and
for you.
It's, you know, it's a book about fitness and fashion. I won't say too much more about it than that, but, it's a book that I've been, it's been lingering on in my head and I've been writing things down and it's starting to take shape. But, you know, as I go out and do initial studies as to how much it may cost, it's quite daunting, but I'm going to try and find some backers and make this happen.
You go, girl. Well, thank you so much, Rosie, for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're so welcome, Kelly. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
That's Rosie Etta of ET Canada. Again, make sure to check out her website, www.rosieetta.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee. Head to the relationship section of any bookstore and you'll find shelves full of various guides on how to catch your heart's desire. There are rules to follow, tricks to play, tests to give, all outlining a dance that, if done correctly, will spin you right into the arms of Mr. or Miss Right. My first reaction to books like those is to wonder, since when has love become a game? And is love really that complicated? When I ask happily married couples how they came to be together, the common thread I've found is that it was a natural, easygoing occurrence. They met each other, felt a connection, and just went with it. I hear a lot of, I just knew that she was the one, or he was the one, or it just felt right. They didn't have to play any cat and mouse games or fill out questionnaires in a magazine to figure out their compatibility. They were just honest and straightforward with their feelings. When you're single and looking, especially if it's been for a long while, it's only logical to start wondering if maybe there's something you should be doing differently in order to find the right partner. We start to analyze everything when dating. What did it mean when she did this? What did it mean when he said that? What should I do so that he knows that I'm a good catch? It turns something that should be enjoyable into an intense practical exam where failure is not an option. Every word, every action, every facial expression becomes loaded and full of a myriad of meanings that must be deciphered and/or manipulated to bring about the results you desire. This is where the head games come into play, particularly the back-and-forth push-and-pull dance that leaves you feeling dizzy and confused. Actually, it's not very accurate to call it a game when no one is having fun. Well, maybe one person is, but I'm sure the other isn't too happy. Are games even necessary when getting to know a person? When trying to see if a potential love measures up in faith and character, little tests may prove useful. After all, it's important to find out all the things that matter to you in regards to compatibility. However, you shouldn't have to orchestrate a complicated game to do so. If you look for it, you'll find out all you need to know about a person and how they interact with you and others, especially when you've given yourself enough time to observe them in various situations and scenarios. I guess having a test speeds all that up, but what happens when they find out you've treated them like a mouse in a maze, seeing how they made it to the cheese? And what if both sides are playing games? How can they let their guard down and just be themselves? Just thinking about it makes my head ache. I'm not one for emotional roller coasters, so for me, games equal drama. There's a difference between being playful and being manipulative, and if that's how you get into a relationship, you may not like where it leads. Whenever you play a game, someone ends up losing, and it just might be you.
As the spring season starts to warm up, so does the advent of garage sales. No matter where you turn these days, it seems there are signs advertising an upcoming garage sale all around our neighborhoods. To help us figure out what gems and what junk are waiting for you at these garage sales is lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, A Back to Basics Guide to a More Balanced Lifestyle, Christine Eisner. Christine, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be back.
Christine, I think a lot of us are skeptics about garage sales. I think, you know, the prevailing feeling is that, you know, it's just a bunch of junk. What do you say to us non-believers?
Well, I say start believing and start saving money, but don't go in and think that you're going to find a Rembrandt painting or a, you might, I doubt it. But you know, go in with realistic expectations and you can come out with amazing stuff. I have just a quick little image. I found a lamp for $15 that I actually bought for my son's house. He didn't really love it. I actually bought it because I thought it was great. And it's in my front entry.
So you find stuff.
And that was $15.
Wow. Now, before you, you know, head off on a Saturday morning, you know, kind of all willy-nilly, should you actually stop and make a plan about what you're looking for, or do you just sort of roll up your sleeves and dig in?
Well, I think it's good to before you leave your house, or, you know, in a day or two before a weekend's coming on, just sort of get a sense of where you could bring a little bit more life into your space. You know, maybe you might need some vases. You know, maybe your glasses are all chipped and you're thinking, oh, you know, maybe, you know, if I found six glasses, seven glasses, eight glasses, that would be a nice thing. These are sort of things that are really good value things to find in yard sales. So, you know, take a look at that kind of thing. You know, maybe, you know, if you, you know, rug sizes, if you're thinking you might want a rug for your family room or your den or whatever, you know, get a sense of the dimension that might be. If you're, you know, trying to like think, okay, it'd be nice to get a table for outdoors or something. I think it's great to have an idea of what you might look for because it gives you sort of a focus. But that said, you know, it's fine just to dive in too, because invariably you go with your list and you'll find something completely different, which is fine. It's part of the fun of it, actually.
I think, you know, this next question is important because I feel like it would change the tone of your adventure. Who do you take on one of these, you know, garage sale trips? Because, you know, is it better or worse to leave your significant other at home?
That's a really good question. And, you know, when you asked it, the first thing that came to my mind, it's a great thing to take your children to, because while you're looking for your stuff, they can be finding, you know, my daughter will find a necklace or a bracelet or, oh, she found those little squirrel salt and pepper shakers that were totally nasty, in my personal opinion, but they cost 25 cents. And there they sit on our breakfast table alongside ours. It's just sort of a nice thing to bring kids to because they can sort of play in the dirt without the cost being too high. And it also just teaches them that not everything is disposable. So I would say feel free to bring your kids with you. You know, one or two, I wouldn't bring like a whole group of them. It's hard to keep track. But I think also in terms of your significant other, you know, either way, I know I'm being very either way, but truly, if you bring your other half along, it can be fun. But by the same token, sometimes it's easier to concentrate and to really see stuff. But if you do go with someone, even if it's with a friend, it's nice for, you know, one person to go in one direction. There's enough room for two or four at a garage sale. So if, you know, if he's going in one direction and he's looking, you know, he might find the record albums or the, you know, who knows, or the sports stuff. And you might be looking at tablecloths, which are great buy at garage sales because we rarely use our tablecloths. Or, you know, not a bad way to divide and conquer. And then if if one of you finds something, then you have the other person right there. I actually think it's sort of nice to go with people, but not to be bound, you know, you don't have to be joined at the hip.
And I suppose at that point, too, you would know if your significant other is into it or not, because you don't want to bring like Debbie Downer to the party.
Absolutely. I don't bring my husband to yard sales.
Yeah, I can't picture my dad going either.
Yeah, he just doesn't. I mean, I come back and he's like, I cannot believe it. You find the gem in the junk. But that's just because he looks at it as junk. But you know, it's not for everybody. I grew up doing flea markets and yard sales and antique stores. And really, this is just another level of an antique store. And there's a lot of opportunity. And, you know, even if you buy something and you sort of make a mistake and it, you know, the chair's too big, I do like to, you know, if I'm thinking furniture, I do like to sort of have measurements or a floor plan in mind or something. I bring a tape measure also. But I, you know, if you make a mistake, it's not like you've spent thousands of dollars on something. So it's a great way if you're just setting up a home, if you're just, you know, you got your first apartment or you're moving out of the house or trying to, you know, redo a room that's not a big deal room. It's a great way to just sort of experiment, be able to make some mistakes if you need to, and not have it, you know, not have to go cry in a corner.
Christine, what types of possessions should we be looking for when we arrive? Because I feel like we need to be training our eyes to spot the good stuff.
Yeah, well, and the good stuff is really, I mean, your good stuff is going to look completely different than my good stuff. And I would say the thing is, first, I would say, I actually take people through this huge antiques market or flea market here in Atlanta, occasionally. And what I tell them is just scan. Don't go in and feel like you have to look at every little item on the table. You know, get a sense of the jewelry. Get a sense of the sports equipment. Get a sense of the books. Get a sense of the kitchenware. Some of the things that I feel are really good things to look at, they're really good value, are things like lamps, because lamps can cost, you know, so much. And, you know, sometimes just swapping out a shade can, you know, totally make it work, or even with the shade. But lamps are great, as I said, glassware, serving dishes, things that we don't use a lot in our own life and therefore don't have a lot of wear and tear on them are great things to buy. But as I said, tablecloths, glassware, silverware, picture frames, throw pillows. You know, it really just sort of, I sort of try to look for the bigger stuff first also. But rugs are a great thing to, you know, if it happens to strike your taste, rugs are a great deal at yard sales.
Joining us on the show is lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, Christine Eisner. Make sure to check her out at www.comfortlivingbychristine.com. What type of stuff do we sort of stay away from? Because I feel like, you know, maybe the person that's actually holding the garage sale would even put out stuff that's broken. And then I feel like there's these, you know, wannabe do-it-yourselfers who are like, I could fix that. And then it's just more junk you're bringing into your house. So you need to be aware of that, I would imagine.
Yeah, if you're not the person that's really going to fix it, then don't do it. Because the last thing you want to do is, you know, it's supposed to be one man's junk is another man's treasure. It's not supposed to be one man's junk is your junk. So unless you really can have that immediate gratification of buying it and, you know, putting it right here, you know, in your home, I would say stay away from it. Don't buy, when Shelly, my daughter, gets married, this will be perfect, and Shelly's 10 years old. It's just not worth it. It's not worth having the clutter in your life. And, you know, in my book, I talk about the importance of streamlining, of getting rid of the obstacles that get in the way. And that's really important. It's something that you need to think about all the time. And the thing is, when you're at these places, you really can find things that, you know, that become your treasures. I mean, picture frames are a great thing to buy because, you know, all of a sudden you get it. Instead of paying $15 for a picture frame, you might pay $1 or $2. I would definitely, if it's not something that speaks to you right away, don't buy it just because it's a good buy.
We sort of touched upon this earlier, but I'm assuming that at some garage sales, you know, people are getting rid of chairs and coffee tables and desks and such. Can you ever find valuable, you know, antiques? And I know you sort of mentioned that that's, you know, a slim chance. But I guess if you have a trained eye, you could spot something potentially.
Yeah, you can. You absolutely can. It's also good to sort of know what neighborhood the garage sale's in. Because, you know, it, not that it means that just because it's a good neighborhood, it's going to have, you know, more valuable stuff. It's not always true. But, you know, yeah, you definitely can. I mean, Antiques Roadshow, I mean, you hear all sorts of stories about people who find that. But it's not the rule. But you can find great quality because people, you know, people are very much in a mindset now that I think people are really starting to realize that their stuff is choking them. And so people are downsizing. They are trying to get rid of stuff, and they're trying to do it in a way that, you know, will make sense for the landfill and make sense for their wallet. So so I think there definitely are, you know, great finds out there. But, you know, if you want to find that stuff, though, the thing to do is to go early. Like, a lot of times you go right, you know, when it's opening up. You know, find one that's in a good area. A lot of times multi-home sales, you know, where there's a lot of stuff. It's not just one family. But plan to get there early, because a lot of times the dealers are out there at those sales. And what they find will end up in their shop, you know, marked up 2, 3, 4 times. So you want to get that stuff first, because that stuff does go quickly.
An important point that I wanted to get across, and I wanted your thoughts on it, especially because I know that you do talk about sort of streamlining in your book. When do you say when it comes to the purchases that you're making at these garage sales? Because like you said, a lot of it is cheap stuff, or the price is cheap, but you know, and I don't think everyone turns into a hoarder, but I feel like there's a fine line that you can get carried away, almost like going to the dollar store too often.
Yes, yes. Or those McDonald's toys that used to be all over our place.
Right.
yeah, well, I think, you know, there's an exercise in my book, actually. I think it's on page 16, and it's words on a grid, and it's, you know, it's you circle the words that describe how you want to feel in your home. And that, this becomes something that's a really helpful tool when you're out shopping, whether it's at a yard sale or at Saks Fifth Avenue. I mean, you can, you know, if you look at something and it is a physical embodiment of how you want to feel in your home, then you should get it. If it's not, if it's sort of halfway, or, you know, why bother? Don't, you know, we don't need things that are picking up dust. I mean, ideally it has, you know, it's something that looks nice in your opinion and also has some kind of a function. But if it's just like a something that's just going to get in the way, one more thing to move around, then I would say, you know, maybe that's when you say when.
Okay. And then I guess just to further that point, if you do purchase something and you bring it home, do you follow the same rule that you would, you know, when buying sort of a piece of clothing, where, you know, you always sort of say, well, I've brought in a new piece of clothing, so an old piece is going out.
I do that too. That's such a good, I do that too. I try to, actually. It depends, but I try, if I bring something in, or before I bring, you know, as I'm walking around sort of thinking, what might I need? That's when I'm looking at, you know, these pillows really are so frayed that it's beyond, you know, tender loving care, and, you know, it's beyond feeling like home. It's getting to be, you know, too much, or they're too dirty and the stain can't be repaired. That's when I like to take things out of my home. I don't even like to wait until something comes in. I try to make it so that I tell my clients, you know, get rid of the things that get in the way before you bring anything new in. So I wouldn't even do a swap out. I would, you know, purge, or, you know, cull out some stuff beforehand, because there's nothing wrong with blank space. There's nothing wrong with, you know, with something that needs to, you know, it's sort of like closet space. If the closet's jam-packed, you can't fit any more in. But if you've got room in your closet, then when you buy something, you have somewhere to hang it. So if you create some space at home, then it's sort of, when you bring something in, you're not going to add it to this pile. You're not going to add it to the stuff that's there already. It's very easy to get tempted in that direction.
Okay, sort of like room to breathe.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then, you know, and then, you know, we have to be our own gatekeepers. We have to say, is this worthy of bringing into my life? And it has nothing to do with how much you paid for it, or how much it's worth, or it just has to do with, will it advance your quality of life, the you know, the magic of each day that you have? And if it doesn't, then pass.
You know, to sort of bring everything all together and get our listeners focused as they head out, you know, to these garage sales, what's your main piece of advice, I guess, to these, you know, weekend warrior garage sale hunters, Christine?
I would say, don't focus in on the details. Just go and have fun. And, you know, they're sort of like farmers markets. They're sort of object farmers markets. Instead of food, it's things. And go and just enjoy it. And if you find something, it's great. Otherwise, you know, there are people that you can connect to. It's a marketplace. And just enjoy the process. And if you end up finding some great stuff to bring into your home, great. It may not happen with the first one you go to, but if you're a warrior, you know that, you know, part of it is that the journey is part of what makes it fun. And then when you bring it into your house, you know, there's a story behind it. And that's a fun thing to just sort of hang on to. It gives it a little bit more meaning than I got this at, you know, the generic place.
Okay. And Christine, where do people get a copy of your book?
They can get a copy of my book through Amazon or on my website, which is comfortlivingbychristine.com. And also through, you know, Barnes & Noble and, you know, bookstores like that. They can get it through there, too. But Amazon and the website are great places to go as well.
Excellent. Christine, thank you so much for your help today. I think you're really putting, you know, people in a good frame of mind heading out there.
You're welcome. You know, I should say one thing. On my website is a blog. It was a 4-day running blog where I basically furnished an entire house from three places: Goodwill, a reuse center, and a carpet remnant place, and Target, of course, my favorite, because not everything can be from yard sales. A 5-bedroom house without really the bedrooms, because this was for college students, for $2,600.
Wow.
And that was like down to the garlic press. So, you know, there is amazing stuff that you can find. There are photographs of this house in that blog, but it's from like January.
Okay.
But it might be something that your listeners might be interested in.
Fantastic. So again, check that out. That's lifestyle expert and author again of Comfort Living, Christine Iser. Her website, comfortlivingbychristine.com.
Bring on the
remix.
Kesha with Blow, the funked radio mix, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. We also featured Santana and Michelle Branch with their hit song, The Game of Love, from 2002. Well, thank you so much for hanging out on the show this week. I always appreciate your time. And a big thank you going out to my guests, the amazing and lovely Rosietta from Entertainment Tonight Canada, as well as the very talented Christine Eisner. And, you know, before I go, as you know, the Oprah Winfrey Show, as we know it, has come to a close after 25 years on the air, and I feel that it's only fitting to leave you with a positive quote of the week from the one and only Miss Oprah Winfrey. She says, "Even the wildest dreams have to start somewhere. Allow yourself the time and space to let your mind wander and your imagination fly." Best of luck, Oprah. Thank you so much for everything you've done for us. I know we all love you. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.